sense if everyone, including all your friends and family and your dog, dislikes him. But Jeff was charming, and he loved me, and I him. He was the Bieber to my Selena, except he had no money and neither of us was particularly talented at the time. We'd somehow gotten into the habit of watching Monday Night Raw, which is a televised wrestling show where there is a bad guy in tight shorts who talks smack to a good guy in different tight shorts, and they both get very emotionally invested and show great feats of strength for a few minutes before one guy's arm is lifted in the air by a bald ref with a belly. I didn't enjoy it because although I'm now friends with some wrestlers and even dated one, it's just not my bag. I appreciate the athleticism and the theater of it all, but it just doesn't do it for me. I did enjoy that Jeff and I had our own tradition and that we'd sneak 40s of beer into my room and make out a little. I live for these nights. Everything was so new to me. I just had my first orgasm a month before, on my own, of course. I taught myself how to masturbate while watching the movie Mannequin. I'm not particularly turned on by that movie, no judgments if you are, but I was watching it alone on the couch one day, and I just put my hand down my pants and rubbed the very top of my vagina and finally came. I was so pumped. It was like a new toy. I tried to do it again right away. I soon learned you have to wait about a half an hour. I really hope girls are having orgasms. Just in case they're not, you should lick your finger and rub it where your vagina comes to a point at the top in a circular motion until you have an orgasm. Show the guy you're with how to do it so you don't resent him for being the only one who is coming. You're welcome, and you deserve it. Also, let him go down on you. Don't be embarrassed. Live your life. Where was I? Anyway, at this point, I think I'd come close to having an orgasm with Mike, but it turns out I'd been confused by the sensation and thought I had to pee. Anyone with me here? No? Okay. I'd excuse myself and go to the bathroom and wipe up all the moisture, which I thought was humiliating. It was later explained to me that wetness was good. Thank God, I thought, since all those trips to the bathroom were getting suspicious. But at that point, I hadn't done a whole lot sex-wise with Jeff. We'd gotten to third base, as they say, and I tried to jerk him off many times, but it never worked, and it became the cause of major frustration on both our parts. I was getting Michelle Obama arms, but no other good was coming of it. I think he had religious guilt about all sex stuff and couldn't mentally get there. Or maybe I sucked at it. Either way, this seemed to either enrage him or embarrass him. I understand how that could be difficult for a guy. And he was my boyfriend, whom I really loved, so one time I told him to jerk off in front of me so he could get over the embarrassment. I acted supportive of his tugging on himself to completion, even though I was kind of grossed out by it. But the plan worked. It helped him loosen up, and I was finally able to help him reach orgasm. This was important to me because I wanted to have sex with him, but not until we'd rounded third base appropriately. I don't know why I got that in my head. Perhaps because in high school we talked so much about getting to different bases. It seemed everything should go in order. The way it was for me growing up was that the guys were always trying to see what they could get from us sexually. We girls were basically conditioned to think we should hold out or we'd be labeled a slut. I wanted to wait to go all the way, because I just wasn't ready. I wanted a little bit of a lead-up to having sex, step by step. After the successful jerk-off Monday Night Raw evening, Jeff and I continued to hang out and watch wrestling every week. Mankind and Stone Cold Steve Austin pretended to beat each other up, and we drank beer. One night, as we lay on my bed with the lights off watching wrestling, I was zoning out. The combination of the time of night, the content of the show, and the beer had me in and out of sleep. At one point, I was lying on my back, not paying attention, and suddenly felt Jeff fingering me. We hadn't been fooling around at all, so it seemed strange to go right to that. It started to hurt, which hadn't ever been the case before, so I looked down and realized he had put his penis in me. He was not fingering me. He was penetrating me. Without asking first. Without kissing me. Without so much as looking me in the eyes. Or even confirming if I was awake. When I startled and looked down, he immediately removed himself from me and yelled quickly, "I thought you knew!" This seemed very strange to me, for him to protest so adamantly with such a prepared defensive line, even though I hadn't yet said a word. I looked down and saw some blood on my bed. I was confused and hurt. He left soon after, and I rolled over and cried. The next day he apologized. He was very upset, saying how awful he felt and that he wanted to harm himself for what he'd done. I did my best to comfort him, and I was genuinely worried about him. I wanted him to feel better. I was so confused. I was confused as to why he would have done this to me in this way. But the most dominant feeling I felt was that the guy I was in love with was upset, and I wanted to help him. I put my head on his chest, and I told him it was okay. I comforted him. Let me repeat. I comforted him. I was still bleeding a little and feeling sore and terribly confused. What had happened was settling in, and I was getting sick to my stomach thinking about it. It made no sense. I was his girlfriend. We'd had conversations about sex and were very open when talking things through like that. I just helped him figure out how to have an orgasm in front of me. I remember being the more sexual of the two of us. If he'd asked me to have sex that night, I think I would have said yes. I didn't understand why he approached it the way he did. Did he feel like he needed to literally sneak it in? He had so much guilt attached to sexual activity, I recall, and lots of fear. Maybe he thought it would be a guiltless, shameless way to do it. Maybe like the jerking off sessions, it was easier for him to do it if I wasn't an active participant. I don't know. But he'd made the decision without me. It wasn't about us, it was about him. I felt sad and betrayed. I thought he really cared about me, but this didn't feel like something someone who cared about you would do. But I still wanted us to be okay. The strangest part is that even though Jeff apologized and told me how bad it had made him feel, I don't remember ever really taking him to task about how it made me feel. I did what most girls do and continued on. I didn't know enough about it. I didn't know that it is incredibly common for sex to be non-consensual. Sexual assault is so widespread, in fact, that we now have big campaigns aimed at teaching boys and young men what it means to get consent. But I was 17 years old, and I wanted my boyfriend to like me. I still wanted to be with him, and I was. We kept right on dating and started having sex regularly a couple months later. The second time we did it, I tried to pretend it was the first time. I even went in my mom's room after and told her I'd lost my virginity. But it was a lie. And I'd also be lying now if I said it didn't feel like my whole experience was ruined. My trust had been shattered. Not just my trust in him, but in a lot of ways my trust in anyone. My fantasy of a beautiful, intimate, memorable moment between two people had been taken from me in a flash. He took it. I didn't know it then, but I know now that it toughened me up in an irreversible way. For many years when it came to sex, I didn't get the luxury of just being myself. Half of the time I was too defensive and guarded, assuming the guy wanted to hurt me or take too much. The rest of the time I was too flippant, almost to the point of being dissociative, as if the act of sex didn't matter much to me. I'd tell myself I could have sex with any guy I wanted even if I didn't care about him. Neither one of these versions of me was real. Today I wish I could say that sex is finally free of this kind of self-consciousness and self-protection for me. But it's not. Until I'm in a committed relationship, I'm on my guard, hard. I want to be the one making all the choices. I have to be with someone for a while and truly trust them before sex is fully fun and carefree. And then I love it. I'm definitely a very sexual chick, but my first experience didn't really set me up for a happy-go-lucky journey to get where I am today. Women, like men, deserve to enjoy sex and to figure it out on their own terms. So many girls have nights like my first time, or worse. Some girls wake up to a friend or boyfriend having sex with them. Some girls are violently attacked in public or in their own homes. 1 out of every 6 women is raped. Of that, 44% of those women are under 18. Anytime someone comes forward about being sexually assaulted in some way, there are so many opinions about it. People have opinions about this chapter. Some might say it wasn't a big deal, or that it was my fault since I was drinking, he was my boyfriend, and I was lying right there next to him. Isn't it sad that when a girl says she was sexually assaulted, our first instinct is to think she's probably lying? Statistics and facts tell us the exact opposite. We demand perfect victims, who better not have been drinking or hanging out at a party in a short skirt or revealing dress, or have ever been known to enjoy sex. The facts in my situation are pretty clear to me still. He was inside of me in a way I hadn't consented to. Many girls remain silent about their experiences, and that is their choice. I'm opening up about my first time because I don't want it to happen to your daughter or sister or friend someday. I want to use my voice to tell people to make sure they have consent before they have sex with someone. I hope all parents talk to their kids about consent, and when you do, please, please don't make the mistake my mother made. Don't do it over a bowl of clam chowder, because that is just gross and creepy. I wish I'd have talked to a parent or adult at the time to sort out my feelings of confusion and betrayal. I wish I'd have stood up for myself more and told Jeff that what he did was wrong. It shouldn't have gone this way. I don't want someone reading this to think, my son isn't rageful and doesn't cry furious tears over a breaded fish sandwich, so he probably understands that he needs to get consent before putting his penis in a girl. But this happens so frequently that clearly we need to talk about it. Everyone should understand that there are no excuses for non-consensual sex. People who commit sexual assault should have to pay the consequences for their actions. I used to do stand-up about this confusing area. I'd call it grape, as in gray area rape. It's not some crackhead who popped out of the bushes in Central Park and raped me. I wasn't screaming no. He didn't keep forcibly pumping away until he finished. He was only inside me for a short time. But it isn't right that it happened that way. Virginity shouldn't be something you lose or give. Sex is something you share. My first time didn't need to be perfect, but I would have liked to have known it was going to happen, or have been part of the decision. Instead, he just helped himself to my virginity, and I was never the same. Things you don't know about me. Constructing a list of things you don't know about me is pretty difficult, because I'm an open book. But here's my attempt. 1. I have a bad scar on my left leg from a surfing accident I was in as a teenager. I think it's cool, but I know deep down it's gross. 2. I speak sign language. I'm not crazy fluent, but I can communicate pretty well. I've learned the hard way that not all deaf people want to talk to you just because you can sign. 3. I am terrified of spiders, and ferrets make me puke. 4. I am not allergic to any food, but eggplant hurts my mouth. 5. I have an innie, not an outie. Talking about my vagina. 6. The birth control I use is the NuvaRing. I've never been paid to endorse the NuvaRing, but I believe I should be. Same goes for Rombauer Chardonnay. 7. I have never been pregnant, but I look like I have. 8. I have never had anal sex. I would be willing, but they say you can't eat for a couple hours beforehand, and I don't see that happening. 9. No one has ever come on my face, but I think everywhere else has been covered. 10. My favorite food is pasta with Parmesan, and I like to eat it as I'm falling asleep. 11. I've been skydiving, but I didn't like it because you have to jump out of a fucking airplane. 12. I don't go to temple anymore, but I like that I'm Jewish. And I enjoy the grossest Jewish food, like whitefish salad and gefilte fish. 13. I like my feet and my ears. I know my mouth is really small, but I like it, and it has gotten me out of going down on several people. 14. My favorite living actors are Samantha Morton and Mark Rylance. 15. I like smoking pot, and I like smoking pot. 16. I've eaten mushrooms a couple times. Fun. 17. I have never done ecstasy, cocaine, or acid, but I feel like I'm already on all of those things. 18. I love Ani DiFranco. You are going to get sick of hearing about this, because she comes up a lot in this book. I've been going to her concert since I was 13. I don't want to meet her ever. I'd start crying and ruin her day. 19. I can't stand Rod Stewart's voice. 20. And the 7th thing you don't know about me is that I'm really good with numbers. 21. My sister tested my IQ when she was getting her master's degree in school psychology, and I tested as a genius in half the categories, and nearly cognitively impaired in the other half. 22. To date, I've slept with 28 people. I can't remember all of their names, but I remember the nicknames I gave them. Third Ball, Pit Bull Guy, Cousin Steve, JK, 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 JK. 23. I faked falling in a dirt pile to get out of running a mile in gym class. I lay in the dirt until someone found me. 24. My favorite poet is Anne Sexton, and my favorite poem is Admonitions to a Special Person. 25. The thing I own the most of is wine, but please send more. 26. I've read the book Tortilla Flat 10 times for some reason. I've watched The Royal Tenenbaums 100 times. 27. My favorite scene in a movie is when Billy Crudup meets Samantha Morton's character at the daytime house party in Jesus' Son, and she's dancing to the song Sweet Pea. 28. At parties, you can usually find me at home. I hate parties. 29. The thing that's on my mind the most is my family. 30. I have a thing for guys with a gap in their teeth. 31. My paternal great-grandmother was a bootlegger in New York City. 32. I'm not sure when I've laughed the hardest in my life, but I am sure that I was with my sister when it happened. 33. The best thing I've ever bought was a comfy bed. 34. The two things I always decline every single time they are offered to me are cocaine and ham. 35. I mostly hate being in museums, except for the American Museum of Natural History. I like the dinosaurs and animal tableaus, and they sell astronaut ice cream at the gift shop. 36. My favorite place I've traveled to in the U.S. is New Orleans. The music, food, and people are the best. My favorite place I've been outside the country is Altea, a little fishing village in Spain. 37. I hate horror movies because I get so scared, but I always forget and watch them by accident. I come up with an excuse about why my sister has to sleep in the same room as me. She's nice about it, but knows it's because I am a deep loser. 38. I don't know if I want kids. Maybe not. 39. One of my favorite things to do is go dancing with Amber Tamblyn and twerk to the best of my abilities. 40. I've never hooked up with a girl, except on camera for my TV show, but it seems fun. This is unrelated to 39. 41. I meditate twice a day for 20 minutes each time. It helps clear my mind and get rid of stress and gives me energy. 42. My sister and I went to Oktoberfest in Munich once and snuck into the tents and had one of the best times of our lives. 43. I'm a pathological liar. 44. Just kidding. Can't knock the hustle. I've been a hustler my whole life. I know you're thinking, check yourself, Amy. You are not Jay-Z. But it's true. You can't be a comic and make complete strangers laugh without a strong hustle. Mine has always been solid, since day one. There's evidence of this as early as my first few months of life. Like most newborn babies, I didn't welcome sleep, and I certainly didn't want to be left alone in a room to sleep by myself. So I figured out how to trick my mother into sleeping on the floor next to me. I cried like hell and didn't let up until she was by my side exactly where I wanted her to be. I'm sure my dad wasn't too keen on this idea, but for months I kept up this impressive scam, dictating the sleeping arrangements for people who were decades older than me. Suckers! My hustle has often involved food, because much like household pets or toddlers, I am food motivated, which is a handy thing to know about me. I was talking my way into the food I wanted from a very young age. When I was 2, I figured out how to break open the kitchen cabinet and eat Cheerios. At 6, I lied to my kind-hearted grandfather's face, telling him that my mom had given me permission to have another yogurt when she hadn't. I let him take the fall for me, and it was never really the same between us. Even now, I still do this. Just last week, when I was leaving Kim's apartment at 1 a.m. after a TV night, she caught me sneaking a bag of microwave popcorn from her pantry to take home with me. When you're a kid, the hustle is oh so necessary. You have so little control over what you get to do, what you eat, what you wear, where you go, who or what you play with. It's a nightmare. So I got started pretty young, working on my tactics for negotiating with adults. I came on pretty strong at my friends' houses because their parents weren't used to my methods and strategies. I'd look them in the eyes, serious as a heart attack, and call them by their first names as a negotiation tactic. Look, Laura, your beautiful daughter and I are going to follow our cake with a bowl of ice cream now. Would you like to scoop it for us, or should I? Like Laura, most parents were caught off guard, laughed nervously, and said, my name is Mrs. Booker, Amy, to which I would reply, I know your last name, Laura. Now can you get me a step stool so I can dig around in your freezer for our second dessert? Sometimes I'd see that my attempts to close a deal made the adult laugh. And making adults laugh was the most power I could ever have. It made me feel like I was one of them, holding some of the reins they always held, especially with male figures of authority, who always seemed to be throwing the book at me one way or another. Whether it was teachers catching me talking in class or cops catching me with beer in my backpack on the beach, it always felt like my only way to get home free was to make everyone laugh. It always dismantled the power structure within seconds. Being funny was my ultimate hustle. Once, when my high school teacher, Mr. Simmons, wouldn't let me leave class to go to the bathroom. Okay, it was actually to walk the halls and meet up with my boyfriend, and Mr. Simmons was fully on to me. I said very loudly in front of the whole class, "That's cool, Mr. Simmons. I'll just stay here, even though I can feel my period blood leaking out of my vagina and about to seep through my pants and onto my chair." Mr. Simmons turned red, everyone else laughed, and I strutted right on out of the classroom. Besides making large audiences laugh at my jokes, I'd say my biggest hustle in life was shoplifting as a teenager. It's not something I'm proud of. In fact, it was a spectacular failure in the end. But I probably wouldn't take it back, because even though this is going to sound weird, I learned a lot from executing the old five-finger discount like it was my job. It was all part of my process of honing my instincts, learning how to take what I deserved in life. Don't get me wrong, I do not condone shoplifting. One of the things I learned from the whole experience was not to shoplift. And I'm aware that when people give you sage advice to grab life by the balls and take what you deserve, they usually mean you should ask for a hard-earned promotion or carve out a little me time for yourself, not rob a well-known department store blind. But when I was a teenager, I took that idea literally. I started out stealing pieces of candy here and there, nothing too serious. When I hear other people talk about their adventures in shoplifting, it's pretty common among teenage girls. They usually recount how they stole something like a cheap pair of dangly earrings or a magazine, and they always attach tons of guilt to it. But I didn't have those feelings because I was targeting the big chain stores. I never took anything from a mom or pop shop or an actual person. To this day, I still hesitate to tell people that I have a record for shoplifting because when something comes up missing, I know they'll suspect me. But never have I ever stolen anything from a person, except food, from Kim's Kitchen. By high school, my friends and I had graduated to stealing bathing suits from stores in the mall because they didn't have sensors on them and they were easy to take. We'd also steal makeup from drugstores. We didn't take these things because we were in need of them. We didn't wear makeup and we rarely went swimming. We took them because stealing makes a teenager feel cool and powerful. Even white girls in the suburbs want to be badasses, and if that meant robbing J. Crew of a gingham one piece, so be it. I guess you could say I worked my way into being an angsty teen, one stolen, shimmery, grapefruit-flavored lip gloss at a time. The first time I got caught was when I was 14 years old and had traveled to Sacramento with my club volleyball team for a tournament. Being in club volleyball meant that when the regular volleyball season at my high school ended, I'd then compete on teams with kids from other schools, meaning I never, ever stopped playing volleyball. It certainly shaped my work ethic and kept a good 30 pounds off me. But it did mean missing a lot of fun weekend shit so that I could sweat it out in a poorly lit gym, eating pasta salad and catching moments of sleep in between games. Even now I find myself feeling sleepy and craving pasta salad whenever I'm in a large school gymnasium. Or regular gymnasium. Or library. Or home. Or now. This is how most of my weekends in high school went. Get picked up on Saturday morning at 5 a.m. and drive 2 to 5 hours to a tournament. Arrive and suit up to play until you're eliminated. Understand that if, God forbid, you make it to the final match, you'll play for up to 12 hours, then take home a little plastic trophy that you will have to pack and move into every new apartment you find yourself in until you throw it away begrudgingly at the age of 24. Come to think of it, it's not unlike film, TV production, except your parents are with you all day and there are no union rules, so you have to play and play until your little knee pads give out or you bleed through. You consume whatever the parents brought to try to one-up each other. Health wasn't really a thing back then, so we eat big chicken cutlet sandwiches and pasta minutes before having to hurl our bodies back out on the court. But back to shoplifting in Sacramento. My teammates and I were out exploring the town. We landed in a place called Old Sacramento, which was full of shops selling shitty novelty items for tourists. Shot glasses, coffee mugs, t-shirts that said the name of the city, and also hilarious phrases like, "I'm not gay, but my boyfriend is." I'd already been stealing for a couple months, and I'd built up quite the reputation with my regular friends at my school. But since this was the club volleyball league, these girls didn't know me as well and didn't realize what a total badass I was. I couldn't wait to show them. I wanted to be popular with the three coolest girls on the team. So I called them over and told them how I'd learned to steal. They were really impressed with how easy I made it sound. And we started racking up the most sought-after items in the stores. Tie-dye half-shirts that said co-ed naked lacrosse, snow globes, and of course the coveted 1 tequila, 2 tequila, 3 tequila, floor, shot glasses. Who writes this stuff? Is it Mark Twain himself? About 6 of us were in on the scam to rob Old Sacramento. After it was over, I walked into my hotel room and emptied my treasures onto the bed. I looked at all of the bounty. In retrospect, not one thing would have cost more than $1.99 to purchase. Not on my watch. 'Cause my watch is free. It just so happened that my mom was chaperoning this particular tournament, and she arrived at the hotel that night. When she got in, she hugged me and told me she had some disturbing news. She seemed really disgusted that some of my teammates had been caught shoplifting and were taken to the police station. I played innocent, partially because I couldn't bear to disappoint her, but also because I was terrified I'd be caught and my new prized possessions, especially the hat with fake dreads built into it, would have to be returned. In the morning, I saw the three chicks whom I'd gotten into this mess, and I found out they were going to be benched for the tournament. They'd been up all night crying. They looked at me like, "How could you do this to us, Amy?" I could see the anger on their faces. They hated me. My whole plan to get them to like me had backfired worse than I could have imagined. In reality, the charge wasn't even going to show up on their permanent records, because they were all minors, but still, they were mad. Honestly, I was a little mad at them, too, for sucking so bad at shoplifting. These fucking rookies, I thought. I should have never taken them under my experienced law-breaking wing. Then I thought about it some more and remembered the sisterhood of the traveling volleyball spandex, and I decided that the right thing to do, both for these other gals and for myself, would be to admit that I'd stolen, too. Is there such a thing as a hustler with a conscience? Predictably, I got benched for the tournament. I stood on the sideline with my knee pads around my ankles, fighting off dirty looks from the girls I'd so desperately wanted approval from. I'd flown all the way to Sacramento from New York to play zero volleyball and get some shitty shot glasses that I wouldn't be able to fill with anything other than water for another 7 years. I guess I got what I deserved. You can't buy or steal popularity and affection. You have to earn those things the old-fashioned way, not the old Sacramento way. I think I learned a valuable lesson about teamwork, sisterhood, and friendship that weekend. But unfortunately, I didn't quite learn not to shoplift yet. For that, I would need a felony on my record. It all went down at a serious department store. Let's call it Schlumingdale's. My stealing had gotten out of hand. This was when my family had slipped from new money to no money, and we could no longer afford to buy the kinds of non-essential things in life you feel you must have as a teenager. So I employed all my well-honed hustling skills to get what Kim and I needed. This was a win-win because Kim got to fulfill her quota of teen rebellion, and I got to own a white jumpsuit. We started doing it more and more, and it had the side benefit of making us feel invincible and powerful. I don't think my stint with stealing expensive clothing is amusing or sympathetic in any way, but it isn't surprising either. When you're a teenage girl, especially one with a broken family and no money, you're newly and fully aware of just how mind-blowingly little you matter in the world. And even worse, I was just starting to feel myself creeping closer and closer to that angry edge, that place most women arrive at in college or maybe during their first job, where you realize not only do you matter very little right now, but this moment in time is probably the most you will ever matter. It's all downhill from here. You're 18 years old, and this is your last chance to take what you can get. I know none of this is an excuse for shoplifting. I really don't think it's a cute thing to do, but it's also not shocking that it made us feel as powerful and invincible as it did. After doing it several times, we felt we were running a great scam. We'd take two of the same item into the dressing room, and then we'd put one in a bag or under our clothes, and the other one out on the rack. "How'd it go in there?" the sales girl would ask me. "Not well," I'd reply, trying to display the self-hatred most women feel when leaving a dressing room. But really, I'd be celebrating what a genius I was for my incredible take-two-steal-one plan. My genius was brutally halted the day my sister and I were put in the back of a cop car. We were in Roosevelt Field Mall in Long Island, a typical mall, maybe on the fancier side as far as malls go. Over the years, a Gucci had appeared, and a Valentino, but that side of the marble halls always seemed especially empty. So Kim and I chose to hang on to the more lively, shittier side. Give me a Hot Topic and an Auntie Anne's pretzel. That was more our vibe. So Kim and I were walking past Schlumingdale's when she said, "We should go in. It's so easy to take whatever you want from there, especially underwear." I should have thought, "This is a bad idea. You've never scouted this place out, and you don't want to end up in jail." But instead what I thought was, "Oh, I need underwear." So we did it. We really did it. We went on a total batshit, no-holds-barred spree. We did not stop at underwear. We took jackets, scarves. "What's this? Dolce & Gabbana has a new perfume? Leopard print onesies? Don't mind if I do. Cashmere tops? 7 jeans? Well, I think I deserve to own those." Kim had been eyeing a tank top with a bejeweled dollar sign, and why shouldn't she have pajama pants with white doily cuffs to go with it? And if she didn't take that strapless teal bra now, she would never again have a chance to own one. Today was the day. And the piece de resistance, a leather fedora. We took it all into the dressing room. I remember squeezing myself into a pair of too small guest jeans while I lovingly fondled a juicy couture jumpsuit. "I'll save this for special occasions," I thought. We were high from the adrenaline as we manically, meticulously, took the tags off each item. I took the perfume out of the box and stashed it in my coat pocket. Good thinking, you brilliant girl, I thought, patting myself on the back. We put all the tags from all the items we were about to be the new proud owners of into the empty perfume box, and we loaded up. We smiled at each other, hugged, took a deep breath, and out the door we went. We passed a pretty girl with shoulder-length brown hair and dark eyes who'd been lurking in the hallway. She's cute, I thought, but bad energy. Kim and I walked toward the blooming exit that led out into the rest of the mall. We held hands, vibing on the same chemicals in our bloodstreams that are enjoyed by gambling addicts, Formula One racers, and Tom Cruise, as we took the plunge past the sensors. They didn't chime. We'd done it. Success. My heart was racing, but I wasn't sweating or doing anything that could be a tell. By this time, we were pros. What a perfect excursion. To top it all off, we had tickets to see our favorite singer, Ani DeFranco, that night. Which of my new outfits would I wear? Definitely going to debut that leather fedora. And then, we were swarmed by five people dressed in civilian clothes. It was the girl from the dressing rooms and a guy I'd smiled at while walking around the store. A whole bunch of plants. It was like the scene in Blow, where the waiters all turn out to be working for the DEA. They circled us, yelling, "Stop right there!" But they didn't touch us. I later found out that they're not allowed to lay a hand on you. To this day, I still regret not running. Had I known they wouldn't have been able to touch us if we ran, I would have Forrest Gumped right the hell out of that mall and not looked back until I reached the ocean or Robin Wright. They kept us there in that strange holding pattern until the store detectives came out and got us. They walked us back to a little room in the bowels of the store. Picturing that moment now still gives me the worst pit in my stomach. I went into protective big sister mode with Kim and was worried about how she would handle this. But more than anything, I was embarrassed. We were caught. We couldn't leave the little room. I couldn't save my sister. I couldn't joke my way out of this. We just had to give in. The five store detectives crowded into the room. They laughed and celebrated their victory and taunted us a little. It was humiliating. Kim was not looking good. She'd always been my cute little partner in crime, but I knew she'd take this harder than I would. She'd recently acquired the tried and true yet mildly disturbing family coping mechanism of dealing with stress and anxiety by dissociating. She was dangerously good at it. She'd basically detach from her immediate surroundings and revert to a kind of catatonic state. I could see she was drifting off and I was losing her. I had to do something. That's when my real hustle kicked in. I did the one thing I can almost always do to make things better. I made her laugh. As the detectives laid out our clothing on the floor so they could assess the charge, I came alive. I pointed to a pair of flannel pants Kim had stolen. "Where were you going to wear those, Kim? Did you join a country club I don't know about?" I went into insult comedy. I roasted her choices as a thief. I comforted her with cracks about her taste. She laughed. She stayed present in her body. "Grand larceny," the pretty brunette exclaimed, and the detectives high-fived one another. My guess was the bigger the charge, the bigger the bonus. The door flung open and a middle-aged guy with a torso bigger than seemed right for his pit bull face walked in. His hair was graying on the sides but not the top. He was radiating smugness like someone who works at the Apple Genius Bar on the day of a product release. "So you thought you'd come in here and steal from my store?" Kim's eyes were starting to waver, and I could tell she was about to head into a black hole. Before he could get to his next megalomaniacal question, I jumped in. "Well, Mr. Bloomingdale." The cat's out of the little brown bag. "It is such an honor to meet you, first of all. Second of all, do you live in the store?" Kim blurted out a laugh and then stifled herself. Needless to say, my jokes didn't save us. I don't blame Mr. Bloomingdale for not appreciating my sense of humor. We got the maximum charge. We were taken to the mall police station, which is a thing, in the back of an unmarked cop car. The cops who drove us were nice. They blasted Pink Floyd's Comfortably Numb, and I was mostly relieved that Kim wasn't numb anymore, that I could make her laugh even though we were on our way to the clink. We sat there looking at each other and holding hands. It was the end of November, so one of the cops' frozen Thanksgiving turkey was resting between us on the seat. At the station, they took our fingerprints and mugshots. Then we sat on a bench while they tried calling our mom. No answer, thank God. "Well, sir, actually, our dad is more our caretaker." "Huge lie." They called our dad and left a message. I explained that he probably wouldn't call back for hours and that our mother was kind of an absentee figure in our lives. Huge lie. I felt in that moment that it was up to me to be my own guardian. My parents couldn't help me, and I also felt an unmistakable sense of resolve that I had to take care of Kim and get her through this. I blurted out to the cops that I had stolen everything. It was all me. They were all my items. The mall cop told us that because Kim was a minor, it wouldn't be a big deal if the charge were on her record. I then took back everything I previously stated and tried to pin it all on her. When it was all said and done, our punishment ended up being community service, but it wasn't too bad. We even made it to see Ani DiFranco at the Beacon Theater that night, singing at the top of our lungs, celebrating our freedom. What better way to commemorate our last days as rebels than spending an evening screaming out the lyrics of the singer who was basically every 18-year-old white girl's Joan of Arc? I remember during her song Swan Dive, Kim and I belting out the lyrics. I don't care if they eat me alive. I've got better things to do than survive. And it felt more exhilarating than wearing all the stolen tube tops in the world. Excerpt from my journal in 1999, age 18, with footnotes from 2016. Dear Journal, it's a Monday and I'm still home. This break has been a lot of fun. It's been more of a learning experience than anything else. It's time for me to reflect on this past month. Footnote, very deep, Amy. Are you reflecting on a Goodwill trip to Guatemala or your time volunteering at a shelter? No, you're reflecting on all the bars you went to. What an insightful mind. Proceed. Last Tuesday to Wednesday, some of us went to Gorman's. Footnote, a bar that allowed underage kids to drink. It was fun. We had good conversations and we danced. Footnote, I would imagine the conversations went like this. I like your shirt. Where is it from? Armani Exchange? Oh, that's why it says Armani Exchange on it. Good catching up with you. Thursday we went to Roulette's. It was a lot of fun. We all got to a good level of drunk. Footnote, most likely blackout. And danced like we had never danced before. Footnote, I will never be able to express how grateful I am that there is no footage of this. We were dancing like lesbians. It was so fun. Footnote, I want to apologize to all lesbians. There is no way lesbians dance the way we were dancing. We must have been incorporating the age-old technique of trying to get the guys to notice us by pretending we were on the precipice of letting the music, most likely Come On Eileen, take over our souls and make us forget what we knew about our sexuality and just start licking each other right there on the dance floor of that shitty bar. Every guy there would have died for any one of us. Footnote, inflated sense of self, Amy? I would like to edit together a video of how I saw myself that night and then what was actually happening. I blame MTV's show The Grind for making everyone think they were Daisy Fuentes. Right before I left, I ran into Nick. Footnote, he was a very hot and strong dude. I remember him looking like Superman or Chris Klein. I was so glad to see him. He really was exactly what I wanted right then. A guy to be really interested in me and that I would like to mess around with. He was extremely friendly. I told him to call me. He called me the next day and asked me to come to a Long Beach bar. I said maybe, but I would have to see. Footnote, yeah, fucking right. I'm sure I started getting ready right then for an entire 24 hours. I saw the movie Girl Interrupted with my friends. Footnote, it was basically a documentary about all of us, except we were less hot. It was really good. Saturday night, I had over a bunch of girls, three of which go to college with Jess Sapp. We got pretty drunk and went to meet up with Nick. He was so happy to see me. Footnote, red flag. He bought us drinks all night. Footnote, redder flag. We didn't pay for a thing. Footnote, reddest flag. I looked amazing. Footnote, I am dying laughing knowing what I looked like at this age. The only amazing thing about how I looked was that people were able to identify me as female. I wore this tube shirt from Zara that ties in the back. Footnote, I remember this shirt. It was made of wool and thin brown leather straps with three ties in the back. It was insanely itchy and gave me a rash all over my body. It looked like what a poor commoner who gets raped by a soldier on Game of Thrones would wear. It was too short, so my belly stuck out, and I had no waist and was shaped very much like an old-timey radio, which I must have wanted to accentuate. He said the sweetest things to me. Footnote, of course he did. I had a target on my head, or my lower back, I should say. When the bar closed, we all went back to my house. Everyone else left, and Nick and I went into my room. We hooked up for like 3 hours. Footnote, This now sounds like a nightmare to me. Just an exhausting bacteria exchange. Pass. I liked how he kissed, but he was very aggressive and rough. He kept trying to shock me, which is sticking one finger up my ass and one up my vagina. Footnote. Thank you, Dr. Schumer. Very sexy. I really spared no details, I guess. But what great writing. Don't you feel like you're in the room with me? It's like we're all sitting on his finger as he's trying to put it in my butthole. I had to be on my guard. It felt different. Not too bad. I just didn't want him doing that. Footnote. It's always been my least favorite way to have my temperature taken. I never let any of my boyfriends do that, so why should this guy? Footnote. That's good logic, right? No one I loved or trusted got the honor of touching the inside of my butthole. You must be knighted by the queen before entering a digit into my buttocks, was my philosophy, I guess. He kept trying to make me touch myself. Footnote. Lazy. I was making jokes like, I don't think we're at that stage in our relationship. Footnote. I think this behavior is probably more typical now with the generation raised on porn, but at the time it was pretty out there in my eyes. The oddest thing that he did was after he had gone down on me, I went down on him for a minute and he was trying to finger me with his toes. Footnote. Or as they call it in ancient China, toeing. I was like, no thanks, and he actually asked why. Footnote. I would like to present this guy with the medal for brass balls. Why? You want to know why I don't want your toes in me? Maybe because that's fucking gross and my pussy is not your own personal moccasin? So until Crocs comes up with a new model called the five-toe vagina shoe, please keep your feet exactly one leg's length away from my lady part. He also kept biting my nipples really hard. Footnote. Guys who do this should be the last residents at Guantanamo. It made me so mad the next day because they were really irritated. So was my vagina from him fingering me so hard. Footnote. If you're trying to make a girl remember you, maybe just write her a poem. He spent the night. I asked if he liked his own space when he slept. He said yes. I jumped up naked and slept in my mom's room. Footnote. She wasn't home, of course. I repeat, she was not in the bed. But I love that at 18 that was already my steez to skip the snuggling after hooking up. I woke up a couple hours later and drove him home. I had Kim come with me. Footnote. Jesus Christ, Amy, your poor sister. Hey, want to take a ride across Long Island with this guy who used me as a puppet all night? She was 14. He kissed me goodbye on the cheek and told me to call. Later we spoke on the phone, and he said that he felt like I just wanted to get him out of my house. He was so right. Footnote. Wow, he was so in touch with what women want. The next night, nothing went on. This week I worked at Forever 21 in the mall. They have me a cashier now, so it's more entertaining. Footnote. I stand by being excited about this promotion. Little did I know I would be wearing their clothes well into my mid-30s. Faked it till I maked it. There's nothing better than being your own boss. Well, there is, actually. Not having to work at all. That is way better. But I've worked so many jobs over the years and have experienced all the unique and specific humiliations that came along with each one. And even when I was doing something for hire that involved zero dignity, I still always liked the feeling of doing something useful. Even as a kid, I just wanted to show everyone I could pull my own weight, which was never less than 150 pounds, even in middle school. For as long as I can remember, I was seeking employment. I felt so stifled and useless during childhood. I wanted to contribute. Lemonade stands weren't cutting it. I hated that I was too young to get a job or join a gym. It's amazing, these things I was so dead set on having are now two of the worst features of my adult life. But back in the day, I wanted in. I wanted the satisfaction of making my own money and being proactive. Before I got paid as a performer, most of my paying gigs were pretty unglamorous, regular, shitty, low-paying jobs. I worked in at least a dozen bars or restaurants in Manhattan alone. And when I was in college, I worked as a house painter for a while. Every weekend at 6 a.m., I'd be up on a ladder with a roller and brushes, painting the inside of someone's house, a Chinese restaurant, or a school. But I liked all those jobs. Even at a job I hated, I always loved the feeling I'd get when I was done. The beer at the end of a shift, or the feeling of looking at the clock and seeing it change to the minute you can leave, is so freeing. That moment you're allowed to walk out the door is an experience that cannot be replicated. I honestly feel for people who've never had to work, because they'll never know that feeling. The people born rich, with their Gatsby-like days spent lying around fanning themselves, wondering if they should go into town, they'll never know the sheer elation you feel when the manager of a steakhouse tells you, "You're cut," after you finish your side work. What a feeling, to furiously roll silverware into napkins and then take that first step outside. Breathing in the air, knowing that you're now on your own time. Heaven. My very first job was being a baby model, because I was an exceptionally cute baby. JK, 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 I was a very average-looking infant. By average, I mean I resembled a pug more than a baby. But my parents needed someone to model the baby furniture they sold. As my parents, they believed I was adorable. That, and they knew I would work for free. I posed in a bunch of the cribs, and I was on the cover of their catalog. It's probably why the company went bankrupt. It was the beginning and end of my print modeling career. I've been meaning to get back into it. My parents continued to take advantage of my work ethic when they made me model stuff from their second store, Calling All Girls, which sold gifts, clothes, and haunted-looking dolls for girls. It was only a good idea compared to their initial business plan, which was to sell shoes. Schumer's shoes? This would have ruined my life as a tween. The slogan my mom devised for Calling All Girls was, "No boys allowed." It should have been, "No customers allowed," because literally no one ever shopped there. Not a smart marketing technique to immediately shun 50% of the population. But anyway, "No boys allowed" was plastered on buttons and t-shirts that Kim and I constantly wore as little walking billboards for our parents. I guess this slogan was supposed to amp up the marketing for the fairer sex, but even more than being pro-girl, it was just straight-up anti-boy. Or it could have been read the wrong way. Like, "No boys allowed, but men are welcome." There were so many wrong turns to be made with this slogan, and so few ways to go right. I was an 11-year-old inviting men to approach me. I looked like a walking To Catch a Predator ad. Chris Hansen should have paid me, not my parents. Either way, I guess "No boys allowed" was supposed to be my mom's not-so-subtle way of telling us that men were bad. I never bought it, but you could say the writing was on the wall, and on the shirt, and the button, for that matter. With the new store, I was not asked to be a print model. I was asked, or rather told, that I'd be spending my weekends at the Javits Center, a huge convention center that held trade shows on the weekends. My parents would showcase their inventory by using Kim and me to display items. We wore "No Boys Allowed" shirts with a picture of a lock and key on them, and the shirts came with a key you would wear around your neck. In retrospect, this was all a little disturbing. I guess my mom thought it was cute for us to be prissy little bitches who locked boys out and dangled the key to our goods in front of them. And the unintentional message had a vague anti-rape implication. I mean, there are some countries where little girls are sold into sex slavery and their virginity is purchased. And there I was at the age of 11, with my 7-year-old sister by my side, literally wearing a key around my neck and a big message that said, "You don't have access to this!" Anyway, Kim and I would stand there in our booth for hours and hours and help sell, I'm sure, zero more shirts for our parents' store. I don't remember what I was paid, but I liked the idea that I was a model. Making me her show pony really backfired on my mom, because when I entered my early teen years, I started demanding a weekly blowout for my frizzy, curly hair. Most 12-year-old girls were not getting blowouts on the reg, but my town hated Jews, and I wanted to hide my little fro. So I began to plot how I could get more blowouts. They were not cheap. So I got the idea that I'd sweep up hair at the salon after school if, in return, they'd blow-dry my hair once a week. I don't remember how long I kept up this arrangement, but it seemed very worth it at the time. I guess the salon, much like my parents, wasn't worried about child labor laws. I loved the work, too. I was part of a team, and I felt useful. But the shop wasn't that busy. I'd sit anxiously and watch the stylist clipping hair, waiting for any of it to fall on the floor. When it did, I'd rush over to it like an annoying human Zamboni or Olympic curler. I was too eager. People complained, and I was let go. It was the first in a long line of completely justifiable firings in my life. I was so eager to work that I'd fake it till I made it, even if I was completely unqualified to do a job. And then I would end up getting fired when my inexperience was revealed. The second time I got fired was when I lied at an interview at a different salon and got a job as a shampoo girl. I thought I was doing well until I completely blew it with the first bald customer. This man only had hair in a small patch in the center of the front of his head, and a thin strip along the bottom in the back, like a clown. No offense to this specific brand of male pattern baldness, but it's accurate to say that this dude had textbook bozo hair. I started washing his hair, just his hair, and not the sizable amount of bald scalp. He shouted at me with a lisp, "Wash my whole head, please!" I said, "No, whenever I wash the parts without hair, the water bounces back and sprays me in the face." He marched right up to the owner, and within minutes I was fired. I really appreciated the bosses who deliberately overlooked my lack of skills and hired me based on my confidence and bravado alone. I worked at a well-known steakhouse in Grand Central Terminal, a really expensive white tablecloth place that catered to fast-talking business people, commuters, and tourists. I was completely unqualified to work there and had no fancy dining experience, but I lied and said I did. I didn't make it past the first interview, but as I was leaving, I overheard someone who was there for a second interview, which gave me the idea to just show up the next day and repeat what I'd heard. Fake it till you make it, I thought. The next day, I showed up and confidently said, "Hi, I have a second interview with Frank." They looked me up and down, confused, but I sat and waited for whoever Frank was. The general manager came out and asked me some questions. The one I remember is, "What is the main ingredient in tequila?" I answered, "Triple sec?" He told me I was very wrong and that it was agave, and hired me anyway. I still don't know why. Maybe my delusional confidence was mesmerizing. For most of my 9 months working there, I was the only woman. It was an all-male staff full of career steak waiters. I had to wear a jacket and tie. The jacket was white, so the dust from Grand Central would settle on me and turn the jacket gray by the end of my shift and make me scratch my face until I looked like I had leprosy. I was too young and blotchy to work there, but I faked it till I made it and eventually got pretty good at it. My sales were among the top there. I'd offer things that weren't on the menu, like a surf and turf, which just meant I'd charge them for a lobster and a filet. I was indeed an asshole. There were other times I showed up unqualified and ended up doing a great job. Like the time in college when I taught aerobics, or as they called it, group exercise, to chicks like me who'd double down on the freshman 15. I did actually have a certification to teach kickboxing, and I was able to leverage that into a job teaching a lot of other stuff I had never even tried before, like yoga, Pilates, spin, step, and dance. Before you go down the path of thinking I wouldn't be your first pick for a fitness instructor, let me inform you that my classes were very well attended and fun. I'd have the girls yell out the names of their ex-boyfriends or whoever they were mad at while they threw kicks and punches. I gained some fans who'd follow me from class to class. What I lacked in physique and expertise, I completely made up for with my likability and motivational yelling. There was one job that I couldn't really physically fake, but I tried anyway. I was 21 years old, living on the West Coast with Dan, who did not turn out to be the greatest boyfriend. More on that later. Maybe my unhappy home life with him inspired me to make the strange choice to work as a pedicab driver. For those of you who don't know what a pedicab is, it's basically like a horse-drawn carriage, except a person on a bike is acting as the horse. I don't know what got into my head that made me think this was a good idea. All you technically needed to qualify was a bike, and the pedicab company would rent you the cart for $20 a day. They'd help you hook up the cart to your bike, and then it was up to you to pedal around town and find human beings to haul. There was a main street on a huge hill, and I'd ride to the top of the hill and hope people would want to pay me for a ride down it. Of course, that never happened. I'd sit there and wait for about an hour and then ride down to the bottom, where naturally people would always flag me for a lift. I wasn't in great shape, so I'd get about halfway up the hill and feel I was about to roll backward, cart, passengers, and all. I'd come to a halt and yell, "Everybody out!" The passengers would have to help me push my cart up the hill. Due to some weird city ordinance, you weren't allowed to quote passengers a fare. You were just supposed to let them pay what they wanted. Can you imagine if prostitutes had to follow this law, too? That was pretty good. Here's a shiny nickel. Fuck that! I gave them my price like a nice little prostitute. I did that job for a few months. I lost about 3 pounds, and that was it. More than I lost teaching aerobics, but still, you'd think I would have lost more weight. But I was so hungry at the end of every shift that I'd binge eat and then drink myself into a blackout so I could forget about having to work the next day. But something I did enjoy about that job was the nice camaraderie among all the pedicab drivers. We'd meet up in one spot in town, park our carts, smoke cigarettes, and talk about how rough our job was. The ultimate faking it situation on my resume was the time I worked at a lesbian bar. All the female bartenders and I would go out and get really drunk before a shift, because despite what I imagined it would be like, bartending for all women was a fucking nightmare. The only thing worse than the drunk drama and the indecisive ordering was the fact that no one ever hit on me. All the bartenders were straight, but I would look over an hour into our shift and they'd be cheating on their boyfriends, making out with female customers. At the end of the night, the bartenders were even drunker than they had been at the beginning of the night, so counting up the money and tips was impossible. Plus, they made us dance on the bar. It was humiliating. I'm not a good bar dancer. I'd wear a pair of pink underwear that read, "I love me," and I'd lift my skirt to display this message and sway around laughing. I ended up getting fired from that job. Not for my gross dancing or my raging heterosexuality, but for closing early without permission. One night, I shut the place down at 7 p.m. just because I felt like it. I was always doing whatever I felt like doing at work. Sometimes it's too hard to hide your feelings just because you're on somebody else's dime. Like at one restaurant I worked in, I decided to stop speaking to the clientele because they were so yuppie and rude. I was done with them. But waiting tables kind of requires you to talk to customers. So I got demoted to being the service bartender, standing in one place and only making drinks for the servers to carry out to the floor. And now that I'm the boss and can be openly honest about my feelings at work, I try to set a good example for my staff to let them know they are welcome to do the same. Everyone is free to feel their feelings on the set of my TV show. Sometimes when I'm extra emotional due to it being that time of the month, I just get on the loudspeaker and announce to all the cast and crew that I have my period. You should be able to be yourself and keep it real at work, no matter what you're feeling. Once when I worked at a little bodega by the train stop when I was 15, I felt my body telling me to eat a lot of the store's hot dogs, so I did. Which doesn't seem that strange, except that I was always working a 5 a.m. shift before school. I was truly ill-equipped for that job, because even though I was supposed to ring up hot dogs, coffee, snacks, and newspapers, I had no clue how to make change. The coffee would cost $1.85, and they would hand me a $5 bill. I'd respond by just staring at the bill, hoping that through black magic the right amount of change would just float out of my hand and into theirs. I'm a great salesman, but numbers hold me back. I consoled myself by eating a lot more hot dogs. They were so good there. My paycheck was a lot lower than I wanted it to be because they were charging me for my enormous hot dog intake. My bosses were two late 40s Indian guys who knew I was an idiot. They'd make themselves feel good by belittling me. They'd stand next to each other behind the counter and trash me. I didn't blame them because I was a terrible employee. I quit when summer came around, and shortly after that, the shop closed down for good. Mine was an honest and simple job, and I think if I weren't on this career path, I'd like to go back to eating hot dogs all day. And I'm grateful to those two guys, because even though they made fun of me every second I was there, they never fired me. One of the things I've learned as a boss myself now is to have high expectations of people, but also to keep it realistic. You can't expect someone to work past their potential. If you've hired someone with the mathematical aptitude of a pet rock, and she eats all your hot dogs and doesn't know how to make change, try to figure out how and where she shines, and let her excel in that area instead. I try to be patient and forgiving with the people I hire, just as they are with me. Mutual respect. But when I realize they don't have what it takes, I do the kind thing and let them go. I always think of that goldfish quote, often attributed to Einstein. Everybody is a genius, but if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it will live its whole life believing that it is stupid. Let that goldfish go someplace where it can join a school, and then hire an actual climber instead. I still love hot dogs and lesbians as much as the next guy, but it was such a great relief when I could finally quit working for other people and focus on working for myself instead. Nothing feels better than running the show on my own now. I'm guessing almost every person reading this knows how much personal dignity you sign over when you work for someone you don't like or for a company you don't care about. But I still have to give it up to all the horrible bosses I've worked for in the service industry, because most of what I know as a boss today has come from those experiences, and from learning not to ever be like them. All those mean chefs who belittled the waiters and the sociopathic restaurant managers who led with fear and intimidation, wielding their minuscule amount of power to scare the shit out of any employee who needed a day off for even the most legit of reasons. All those assholes really showed me several specific versions of who I didn't want to become if I was ever in charge. So I guess the 9 million waitressing and bartending jobs I had really paid off in the end. But it's also nice to learn by positive example now and then. I got more value from just one day on Tina Fey's set and 2 days on Lena Dunham's set than I got from any other long-term job I've had. Now that I spend most of my time on